Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. We are joined today by the internationally renowned psychologist, author, and science journalist, Daniel Goleman. For 12 years, Dan wrote for the New York Times, reporting on the brain and behavioral sciences. His 1995 book, Emotional Intelligence, was on the New York Times bestseller list for a year and a half, as well as being a bestseller in many countries, and is in print worldwide in 40 languages. He's the author of many other books on a wide array of topics, including self-deception, creativity, transparency, meditation, social and emotional learning, eco-literacy and the ecological crisis. And he recently collaborated with the Dalai Lama on the book A Force for Good, the Dalai Lama's Vision for Humanity. He's here to talk to us today about his latest book, which he co-wrote with his longtime friend and collaborator, Richard J. Davidson, entitled Altered Traits, Science Reveals How Meditation Changes Your Mind, Brain and Body. Hello, Dan. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Barry, it's a pleasure to be here. I've heard about your podcast for years, so I'm delighted finally to get on it.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, arguably the book's goal, the main aim of the book is to separate the wheat from the chaff in terms of the research into the efficacy of meditation, provide a sound scientific rationale for its various benefits. However, it's also the story of a really great, enduring and mutually supportive friendship between you and your co-author, Richard Davidson, which for me at least also gave the book a wonderful sense of narrative alongside the hard science. Could you perhaps begin by telling us something of that friendship and how it was indeed meditation that first drew you together?
Well, when I was at Harvard and then got a postdoc to India for 2 years, I got the postdoc because there was one faculty member who was sympathetic. The rest of them actually were a little either indifferent or actually hostile to my interest in meditation. This was many years ago. But when I returned from India, there was one kindred spirit, this fellow Richard Davidson, Richie as we call him. He too was interested in meditation. So instead of being the lone outcast, Richie and I formed a very strong bond, which has continued to this day and actually I won't say culminated, but encompasses our writing the book together, which in a way was circling back to respond to the negativity that we received as graduate students at Harvard.
Okay, and what would you say was it that sparked your interest in meditation? Because it wasn't popular at the time. Did the Beatles play a part?
Yes, the Beatles played a part. I was at Berkeley as an undergraduate for a few years, and all there, the Beatles very publicly became advocates of meditation. I thought I'd try it because I was anxious. Yeah. And I found, it calms me. I started out with the mantra method and did it, semi-religiously for my undergraduate years. And I found, in the morning it calmed me and focused me. And then in the evening I'd fall asleep. I was chronically sleep-deprived as an undergraduate. But it was a very rewarding experience. And I was also interested in the systems within which meditation had been developed. And I realized that when I got into graduate school and I was studying Western theories of psychology, these were Eastern theories of psychology.
Right.
Even though they were formulated within spiritual traditions, you could see them as models of the mind, of ways to work with the mind, meditation being one of the main interventions and what that would do. So it was a cohesive system that I thought would be very important to bring to the West.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you've written many books, Dan, and so has Richie. But you say this is a book you've always wanted to write. So what took you so long?
When Richie and I did our dissertations at Harvard on meditation, there were only 3 peer-reviewed articles that we could find anywhere that had anything to do with meditation. One was from India, one was from Japan, one was from Harvard. And when we look at them now through a lens of rigorous methodology, none of them met our criterion for inclusion in the book. The book, which in America, the States, is titled Altered Traits, How Meditation Changes Mind, Body, and Brain. And in the UK and Commonwealth countries, it's The Science of Meditation, same book. In this book, we waded through, listen to this, there are now more than 6,000 peer review articles on meditation, more than half of them within the last 5 years. It's just an explosion of scientific interest. And we sorted them out using very strict criterion and found about 60 really impeccable, A-level journals. They had the proper control groups and so on. And they showed real benefit from meditation. And those are the ones that we focused on. So I'd say one of the things that took us so long was for the field to catch up with our interest and our hunch that, in fact, meditation, as we experience in our own lives, does change you in profound ways.
Okay, and given that some of the data comes from Rich's lab, how have you both personally tried to avoid confirmation bias with your own research?
Well, I don't do research. I'm the science journalist.
Yeah.
Richie does research, and he is very explicit about that. He's very aware of confirmation bias. And so he has people in his lab who are out-and-out skeptics who don't believe meditation is particularly of value. And also, the reason that we use very rigorous methodological standards was to overcome confirmation bias in the sense that these are studies that have used all the methodological safeguards that behavioral science and brain science deploys to guard against it. And also, we're interested in negative findings as well as positive ones. We feel that this gives a sharper sketch of the whole truth about something.
And why the American title, Altered Traits?
That refers to a theory that Richie and I have had for decades, which is that it's not the altered states that matter, the temporary, maybe pleasant experiences you have while you meditate, but rather the ongoing shifts in your brain, body, and mind that manifest in your daily life. And that's what really counts. And we say that because, first of all, we saw that just a temporary state doesn't really mean much. You could get there through drugs, get there through medication, get there through many, maybe biofeedback or neurofeedback or something. But what really matters is who you are. And so we wanted to focus on that shift.
So in a sense, are you saying that you're cultivating a sensibility, a different way of attending to the world?
Not only a different way of attending, that is one of the big shifts that happens. Attention sharpens, you become more present, but also you become more relaxed about life. You're more equanimous. Another change that we value is more compassionate, being kinder, being more available to other people, whether it's merely with your full presence or actually helping someone in need. We feel that these are the kinds of dimensions and shifts in a person's overall being that really matter the most. And here we were guided to some extent by the ancient psychologies, which all posit these shifts as the end product of serious meditation practice and other corresponding and complementary practices that support meditation. So we saw that the ancient psychologies all posited more or less the same shift, an altered trait. And now the modern evidence had caught up with it, and we could show that indeed this does seem to happen. Plus, I have to say, I experienced meeting beings in Asia who had gone through those shifts and who exemplified the very altered traits that the classical literature said would happen.
Sure. Okay. Well, just for the uninitiated, Dan, how does meditation differ from mindfulness, and how does mindfulness differ from simply being present? I think sometimes people often get confused with those three things.
There's a lot of confusion, particularly because of the way in which mindfulness has been overhyped, if you ask me. It's being sold into businesses as a cure-all for everything. But, mindfulness is one variety of meditation. There are many, many kinds. And it's not just that. Mindfulness is also in some systems not even seen as a meditation in itself, but as an adjunct to meditation. For example, if you do a concentrative practice where you keep your mind on your breath or on a mantra sound that you repeat silently in your mind, mindfulness comes into play when your mind wanders and you notice it wandered and you bring it back. And in some systems, that's the way it's defined. So mindfulness, in another sense, is different from everyday presence in that when we're being present, we're simply attending to something. This in science is called the orienting response. We're looking at something because it's of interest, it's salient, whatever. Mindfulness adds to that, in some definitions of mindfulness at any rate, being present in a particular way without judgment, without reactivity, and without following trains of thoughts about whatever's going on, but simply staying with whatever you experience. So mindfulness, depending on the context, means different things.
Okay. Well, let's dive in then. Let's have a look at some of the main findings. First of all, that meditation helps to reduce mind wandering. Why is that important? And what's going on neurologically for that to occur?
So the mind wandering system is well known. It's sometimes called the default system in the brain, in the sense that when you're not doing something in particular, like doing your maths or balancing your checkbook, and your mind just goes wherever it wants, this particular system of the brain lights up. And so mind wandering is what the mind does when it isn't given some other task to do. And mind wandering in meditation is really the opposite of what you want to do. Every meditation system has you work out attention, so to speak, to try to develop a particular way of attending. And mind wandering is antithetical to all of those, because at mind wandering, the mind goes randomly wherever it wants. But in meditation, you're bringing some discipline to attention. And in fact, one of these strong findings is that not just mind wandering becomes less, but every measure of attention gets stronger. In a sense, you're working in a mental gym. Every time your mind wanders and you bring it back, it's very parallel to going to the gym and lifting weights. Every repetition makes that muscle a little stronger. And every time you bring the mind back to whatever your focus is or your attentional stance in meditation, we think the neural circuitry for that becomes stronger. We think that's why, in fact, MRI studies, brain studies, and scans show that the systems in the prefrontal cortex that manage attention become more connected, become stronger.
So there's a sense of integration between the reptilian and mammalian brains and the prefrontal cortex, we could argue, is the more human brain.
Well, I think the prefrontal cortex is where we want to be, and it does typify humans. It's bigger in humans than in any other species, but it's also where we plan, where we attend, where we make decisions, where we learn. It's the part of the brain which is as rational as we become, and it's always in tension with the emotional circuits, particularly those centering on the amygdala, which is the brain's radar for threat. And in meditation, it's very clear that with repeated practice, the circuitry in the prefrontal cortex can manage the amygdala better, get stronger. And this is probably why people become less, hair trigger reactive, like, oh, that made me so mad.
Yeah.
With time, you recover more quickly. And by the way, these benefits show up to some extent for beginners, particularly in mindfulness, which now is the most studied form of meditation, but also long-term meditators, the findings are that these same changes get stronger and stronger. There's a dose-response relationship, apparently, so that the more you practice, the stronger the benefits become.
I've heard that there's been studies of people who suffer from addiction, and there's been MRI scans of what's going on neurologically. Then the opposite actually happens. There's an actual pruning between the prefrontal cortex and, was it the striatum and the amygdala?
Yeah.
And that sort of affirms that in a sort of opposite way.
Yes, so I think you're talking about the research of Judson Brewer at the University of Massachusetts, who stepped into the role of director of the Mindfulness Institute that Jon Kabat-Zinn founded years ago. And Judson is a neuroscientist. He was at Yale before, very interested in addiction. And he finds that the underlying circuitry that primes addiction seems to weaken with mindfulness. And he's using mindfulness as an intervention in helping people with addictions.
Well, and related to this idea of mind wandering, meditation also helps us to keep our attention on what is important. Now that raises the question how we know what is important in our everyday lives. To what degree does meditation cultivate discernment as well?
Well, I think to the extent that we get more clarity, that this is a function of the prefrontal cortex, that you're less pushed around by mind wandering, by your random, particularly negative emotions, and better able to focus. And I think with that focus comes a better sense of what your ethical hierarchy actually is and what matters to you. I think it's probably a natural byproduct. I don't know of any research that specifically speaks to this, but that's my hunch.
So it makes us wiser then?
We could infer that.
Okay, and you also said earlier that it helps us to become more compassionate. Now, there are specific practices to aid that. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I'm not sure every kind of meditation makes people more compassionate.
Okay.
Some military forces have used meditation because it helps people focus better and be calm.
Yeah.
But it doesn't necessarily make them more compassionate. and the kind of meditation that cultivates compassion explicitly does so. For example, the loving kindness practices in the Vipassana insight meditation system. And of course, there are analogs in Christianity and many other religions, but explicitly cultivating the attitude of charity, as you would say in Christianity, or wanting for help, of metta is the Pali word for the loving kindness, where you wish people that you're grateful to in your own life, that they be safe and healthy and happy and so on. Wish it for yourself, for people you love. Now, that's easy. Then the harder part is wishing it for strangers, for people in your region, for people everywhere. But it turns out that this meditation seems to strengthen the circuitry in the brain for compassion, which turns out to be the mammalian caretaking circuitry in humans. It's a parent's love for a child. And you're extending that same attitude of being there for the other person to everyone everywhere. I think that's ethically, that's a plus. And I think it's perhaps the only meditation that strengthens an ethical stance explicitly.
That's very interesting. Well, let's move on to another benefit you highlight. You argue that it strengthens the ability to say no to emotional impulses, such as, say, when someone cuts us up in traffic or just simply saying no to that, that extra beer. So what's going on there?
What's happening, as far as we can tell, is that the connectivity between the prefrontal circuits, which can just say no to emotional impulse or emotional reactivity, becomes stronger. And with that strengthening, we become less knee-jerk reactive, like, oh, that guy cut me off, I'm going to yell at him. Or, I've got to have that, 10th beer or 8th beer or 3rd beer, whatever it is, you shouldn't have. It's easier to say no to that. And also, what we find in longer-term meditators is that in addition to being less reactive, when you do become upset, you recover more quickly. That's the operational definition of resilience, how long it takes you to recover from peak arousal back to calm.
And on that topic of resilience, it seems to be very helpful with regard to stress and pain as well. I'm thinking of the work, for example, of Jon Kabat-Zinn, who you mentioned earlier.
Yes, well, Jon Kabat-Zinn, who, by the way, was a friend of Richie and I back in Cambridge when we were first getting interested in all this. Jon, of course, developed the method called mindfulness-based stress reduction. It was a practical application of mindfulness. And in his first try at it, he was in a medical center, and he wanted to offer this to patients who had chronic pain, for example, that medicine no longer could help.
Yeah.
He didn't think it would cure the underlying condition, but rather it would improve the quality of their days. And, palliative care, as it's called, helping people live a better life, even with chronic symptoms, is, I think, a very compassionate aim and helps people, even those with a disease that can't be cured, have a fuller life.
What about a sense of purpose? You talk about that too, and it can help in that way.
Well, I think a sense of purpose, of course, needn't rely on having a meditative practice. Many people without meditation have a sense of purpose, but I do believe they can be more focused on keeping that dominant in what drives you in, you know, in your activity day to day. And I think meditation helps there. I think it also may help you get in touch with what feels right.
Well, let's look at the self, how we go about constructing that, the problems that can at times cause, and how meditation can help there.
Well, self-grasping, as it's called in some meditative systems, or just self-fixation, means that we're absorbed with our own problems, our own wishes, our own desires, and we impose that on the world. It's the opposite of a compassionate stance, where you see other people and empathize with them and understand their need. But the self, it's neuroscience, cognitive neuroscience is showing, is a kind of inner optical illusion that has to do with many different brain systems coming together. And, you know, some part of the mind stitches together from that, the sense of I, me, mine. And meditation deconstructs that. At least many meditations aim to do that. I don't think concentrated techniques do necessarily, but mindfulness and insight methods do. And with the deconstruction, it's interesting that every major spiritual tradition says that this deconstruction is really the key to the kinds of changes that you want to see. Oddly enough, and this is a big paradox, it's one of the least researched parts of meditation in the West. There's lots of research about how it sharpen attention and make you calmer and even more compassionate. Almost nothing on how it will help you reduce your self-fixation.
So arguing in a sense it can help us become less attached. We're not so fixated about, as you say, the I, me, my. But is there a danger that we can sometimes become detached? I'm thinking of a friend's mum whose son got perhaps a bit obsessive about meditation. She said he's becoming a bit of an observing machine. I think he got the message wrong a bit. I don't know. Have you come across that?
Yes, I think it's a danger where meditation becomes used as a defensive maneuver, particularly by people who are what are called avoidant, which means that you don't want to experience emotion, these strong emotions, so you tune out. And there's research at the University of California, Davis, by Philip Shaver on people who are avoidant, which shows that they actually have develop a pattern in their brain where they can't tune into the ordinary emotional signals, which are very important for understanding yourself and other people. So the particular signal they can't tune into is anxiety. And meditation can be misused to help strengthen that defensive maneuver, and I think you end up with the person like you're describing.
What about meditation boosting our health in general?
Well, this is one of the areas where maybe the data is a bit overhyped. There is some very suggestive data, some strong data, if it's borne out, that would say that, yes, maybe it's true that it helps us with our health. So far, it has been clearly shown. And here I'm thinking of the fact that, as Jon Kabat-Zinn said, these methods are to help you experience life better. They're not going to cure your disease. So far, there's no study that shows any meditation will cure a biological disease. However, there's data from Davidson's lab, which needs to be replicated, which shows that when long-term meditators, these are people who have done more than 1,000 lifetime hours of meditation, do a day of meditation, the genes that create inflammation in the body downregulate. They go quiet. And that could have very positive biological consequences, because in chronic diseases of all kinds, arthritis, asthma, cardiovascular disease, cancers, and so on, it's inflammatory processes which make the disease progress. So if we can reverse that with meditation, then it might be a positive intervention in our health. Mm. So that's one promising avenue, but it's early days.
Yeah, that's interesting. Just before Christmas, I interviewed an epigeneticist, a guy called Dan Keating, and he was saying that if you don't catch it early with what he calls super nurturing, arguably the most effective thing you can do in later life if you have a stress response fused into the on position is practices such as meditation.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And at the same time, he'd probably agree that this is a good guess and we don't have the scientific data to support it yet, but it probably will come.
He said exactly that, yes. Okay, well, let's move on to meditation and psychotherapy. What have studies shown there about its efficacy?
Well, here it's a little more promising. The data has shown that meditation can be as effective for anxiety or depression. I'm talking about the garden variety, not bipolar depression, which is very biological. But it can be as effective as medications. And, of course, there are no side effects generally from meditation. So there, I think the evidence is good that if you meditate seriously, it will lower your anxiety and make you less depressed. On the other hand, it has been shown yet for other specific psychological disorders. One of the promising avenues, though, is for attention deficit. There are studies that show that the medications that are, at least in the States, far too often prescribed for kids with attention deficit, that those work well in the first year, so-so the second, and not very well at all after the third year. However, training attention, helping kids get better at it, because it is a muscle of the mind, is an untried intervention, and it makes both common sense and early data suggests that it may just work. So, you know, wait a year or two and we'll see.
Earlier on, you spoke about the integrative process between the midbrain and the prefrontal cortex. Is there any evidence to suggest integration is also occurring cross-hemispherically when we meditate?
Well, we do know from data in Ritchie's labs and others that highly advanced meditators have a remarkable neural harmony, in that the different parts, the many different parts of the brain, seem to be in the same rhythm. And it's not just where something happens, but also the timing of what happens in the brain, we know, is very important. And so the neural harmony, particularly in what's called the gamma range, gamma is the strongest EEG wave seen ordinarily only, for example, when you have a creative insight, might last a quarter of a second, half second. In the Olympic level meditators that Ritchie has studied, you find gamma in their ordinary brainwave state. It's quite remarkable, never been seen before. And not only gamma, but gamma in harmony, you know, various parts of the brain.
But for the average meditator, I don't know if you've done any studies on how often people do meditate. To what degree would you say we need to meditate? Not, you know, the high gamma level, in order for the benefits you've been talking about to take effect?
I think it works like this, Barry. The benefits, for example, the positive feelings from loving kindness meditation show up within 10 minutes of meditation. And the more you meditate, the stronger the benefits seem to be across the range that I described. So I would say the benefits show up from the beginning, but get stronger the more you do it. And yeah, this extends into the upper range where, you know, the people in the Olympic level study had 12,000 to 62,000 lifetime hours. And some data suggests that you get even more benefit on retreat than from daily practice. Well, of course, daily practice is sine qua non. That's going to give you benefits too, but perhaps a little more slowly. So I can't say, you know, oh, 22 minutes a day.
Yeah.
Like, the more you do, the better it is.
You talked earlier on about the hype, which there seems to be a lot of, and it obviously doesn't do the wider understanding of meditation any favours. So are there any tips for discerning the signal from the noise? And to what extent might the science outlined in your book perhaps provide a platform for legislation to guard people against it, because it seems like people are being duped?
Yes. So let me speak to the legislation question first. We live in a capitalist economy where people are duped continually about all kinds of things. For example, that you need a new this or that.
Yeah.
But in fact, it's just the same old one with a few little tweaks to make you interested in it. So I don't put much faith in legislation as a way to, safeguard the truth about meditation or about anything that in any sense is a product. I think that good science is the way to help safeguard the truth about meditation. That's why we did the book. We gathered all the best science we could find for people to know what the real benefits are. And we did that instead of, trying to corral all of the hype that's going around about meditation. It's endless and it changes daily.
Yeah.
So rather than do that, we thought, well, let's just say what is true. And I think the fact we have a chapter in there, which is about how to tell if a study is good. In fact, I had a little fun with it. I used my Harvard dissertation. I tore it apart as an example of bad research. What we're really doing there is helping people see what makes good research. What kind of control group do you need, for example?
Yeah.
This is a basic fact that a lot of people don't understand. But if you ask people, do you feel better after that 8-week mindfulness training? They're going to say yes. But if you do what Richard Davidson did and design a training very parallel to the 8-week mindfulness training, that doesn't include mindfulness. It's about exercise and nutrition. The people teaching it are just as positive. You get the same changes. So it's makes you more wary of just self-report, for example, as a gauge of whether meditation helps people. It makes you want to look at more at measures you can't gain, things like biological changes, brain changes, very solid cognitive tests, so on. And we've gone to that level. And the other thing is, who is saying it? What's the basis of the claim? Is it a top-level scientist? Is it someone who actually isn't a scientist at all, who's maybe read a headline about a bit of research? Was the research published in one of the best journals or a kind of fifth-rate journal?
Yeah.
These are the kinds of questions to ask.
How important, then, is it to have also a good teacher?
I think the quality of the teacher is absolutely... I was talking to John Kabat-Zinn, a friend of mine, actually still these days, about MBSR. And he said, there are a lot of really excellent MBSR teachers, and there's some I'm not so sure about. And he thinks that this may affect how well people do with the method itself. And I think it's true of every meditation practice. So one of the things you can look at, even with an app, is who's teaching and what's their experience. Are they new at it, or have they been doing it for years? Are they seasoned or not? That's a basic question. It's just due diligence.
And to what degree do you think it's helpful to do meditation alongside other integrative practices, such as perhaps, say, critical thinking, appreciation, engagement with the arts, volunteering, travel, etc.?
Yes, I think all of that is to the good. And in fact, in the original traditional context from which meditation was removed, there were many ancillary practices, a lot of which were left behind when these things were brought into the modern world. But everything you name and more, I think, is actually excellent recipe for cultivating a full personality, becoming the best person you can.
That brings me to my next question. In our modern day cut down pragmatic approach to meditation, what would you say are the most important things that may have been abandoned or forgotten from the ancient traditions?
Well, one of them, we actually list several in the book, but an ethical framework, for example, that is a universal in the traditional practices and a by the way or not mentioned at all in modern meditation methods. I think having a supportive community, which was always part of the recipe too, is crucial and helpful. Many people are isolated and on their own, and it's easier to fall by the wayside. Another thing, though, that I don't think we'll get very easily is a culture that supports full-time meditation. Asian cultures traditionally have done so, and that allows those cultures to cultivate a few people who go to the top levels. And I don't see that happening as much in modern life in the West. In fact, maybe not at all, unless you're independently wealthy and decide you're going to cultivate a practice, a meditation at the level of, say, a monk or a nun or a yogi in Asia. It doesn't happen.
Yeah, sure. Is it important to stress that meditation is not magic? It's not a cure-all or a panacea?
I think meditation, in a sense, is hard work, in that you have to sustain it, you have to keep at it over time to get the real benefits. So in that regard, it's hard work. It's not an easy thing. On the other hand, there are benefits that will show up from the beginning, but those benefits will disappear if you stop.
Yeah.
So it needs to become a lifelong habit.
Can it sometimes be harmful?
Well, there are people who have very upsetting experiences, particularly on some retreats. And so for that reason, a number of retreat centers I know about ask people about their mental health history, whether it's the meditation that causes the episode or just some pre-existing vulnerability in the person. I suspect the latter, because freshman year in college also is known for that, or, you know, entering the military produces people who have unfortunate experiences. So I think that remains to be sorted out.
And how would you say business and academia has responded to all the interest in meditation?
Well, academia was, as I experienced as a graduate student, initially non-receptive, and now increasingly so. The fact that that more than half of the 6,000 peer-reviewed articles have been published in the last 5 years, and almost all of them by people who have an academic post, suggests that now this is quite accepted. And I think it's the scientific evidence that's made it so. In business, I think that standards for evaluating the soundness of a particular method or a particular teacher aren't as rigorous as they might be. But even so, it's spreading in business too, as well, by the way, as in education. Many schools now, for example, are starting to offer mindfulness, which I think is to the good. I did a book, The Triple Focus, A New Approach to Education, with a fellow at MIT, Peter Senge, which is about what's called social-emotional learning. These are basically, it's emotional intelligence for kids, you know, from earliest grades until they go to university. There are many programs like that. What we're suggesting is that the next step would be to help kids with training their attention. That helps them be better learners. Meditation is a way to train attention.
Yeah, and I think, and just back to what we were saying about decision-making, that if you respond to your experience rather than reacting to it, you're less likely perhaps to make blinkered decisions about things, because you've got the time to reflect on that decision.
Gary, that's interesting, because the social emotional learning movement has 5 goals. One is to help kids be more self-aware, more attentive. Second is to use that to master their emotions and be better, more focused on their goals and less impulsive. The third is empathy, to tune into other people. The fourth is to use your social skills to get along better, to be a better team player, and so on. But the fifth is good decision making,
Yeah. Which
comes from that. So I think you hit the nail on the head. That also means things like, you know, in the teen years, how to say no to drugs and keep your friends, which is a vital kind of a decision.
Sure.
Or not to get pregnant. If you make the bad choice, it can alter your life track for the rest of your life.
There must be countless examples in your experience of how meditation has changed people for the better. At this moment, is there one that particularly comes to mind?
Well, yes. My wife tells me I've become a little kinder.
Yeah, but my partner says the same thing to me. I've got a guest house, Dan, and I normally meditate in the morning when it's really quiet. And she notices when I don't meditate, because she just says I'm less grumpy.
Exactly. Yes. I think these are the best proof.
Okay, and my last question. What's your understanding of the middle way, and how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
I find it a very appealing concept, because it's the way between the two extremes, whatever those two extremes may be.
Yeah.
When it comes to meditation, one extreme may be there's only one right way to meditate, it's my way. And another extreme might be it doesn't matter at all. why bother? I think the middle way keeps you on the path.
Brilliant. Okay, well, it's been a great pleasure talking to you today, Dan, and I think this is a really important book that deserves the widest possible attention, and thank you very much for talking to me today.
Barry, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You can find out more about Middleway philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.